Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. So we'll begin by chanting the verses that you're memorizing. Is that starting with 6.1.15? Hare Krishna. So today we're going to be covering, just a quick summary of chapters 17, 18, 19, which brings us to the end of the sixth canto. Okay? And today we're going to be concentrating on 6.17.28 will be the verse we're doing. So to go over to where we are at this point, as you remember, some chapters ago you had the story of Vritrasura and the battle between the demigods and Indra and how Vritrasura was killed. And then we found out that Vritrasura was actually a great devotee. Although he appeared in a demoniac form, he spoke very eloquently and displayed many, many symptoms of one who is a pure devotee of the Lord. So now we're kind of going back a little bit in time and understanding how it came about, how Vritrasura, who appeared to be a devotee in this demon form. So chapter 17 is a description of how that happened. So we're starting with the story of King Chitraketu. And in chapter 17, Chitraketu is cursed by Mother Parvati. So Chitraketu at this point had achieved everything. He had had the darshan of the Lord. He was a great king, a great pure devotee, had great mystic yogic powers. He was traveling in his airplane around the universe. He had only these unlimited powers like this. And once they were traveling to the abode of Lord Shiva, and Chitraketu noticed that Lord Shiva, although he was a great devotee, he was so austere, he was so expert in penance and sacrifice and austerity, but yet his beautiful wife Parvati, he noticed, was sitting on his lap while he was on his, I don't know if exactly his throne, but his seat or whatever it was. And so Chitraketu was marveling at this. How is he supposedly such a great renunciate? He's so austere, but yet he's acting as though like an ordinary person. Engaged in relationships with his wife. Now, why exactly he did this is somewhat of a mystery. It's obviously part of a pastime because he was a great realized devotee. He certainly understood fully the position of Lord Shiva. But for this particular pastime, he made this remark, which was actually somewhat insulting to Lord Shiva. Now, Lord Shiva was not insulted in the least because he understood a greater purpose. And I think in one purport, Srila Prabhupada quotes, I think it's Jiva Goswami, is stating that Lord Shiva understood the greater purpose that Chitraketu was giving a warning to ordinary people and things like this. And he wasn't really directing it specifically at Lord Shiva. But although Lord Shiva was very equipoised, he did not take any offense, his wife Parvati did. So on behalf of her husband, she became insulted because she felt, as a good wife, she felt his honor was being defamed. So so Parvati curses Chitraketu, and she curses him that he will be born in a family of demons for this great offense to Lord Shiva. Now, his reaction, he was not at all upset. Chitraketu said, "This is fine. I accept this. You are probably correct. This is, I will simply continue serving Krishna in any situation of life. If I am born as a devotee, if I'm born as a demon, makes no difference to me." Almost like, you know, thank you for your kind curse, and I'll go about the business and devotional service. So he gives a very nice talk in the beginning part or the middle part of the 17th chapter. And now where we are up to today is Lord Shiva is beginning to speak. And Lord Shiva is glorifying the devotees and glorifying actually Chitraketu's wonderful example. So we'll get back to that today. And today's a very, very important verse explaining the position of a devotee as spoken by Lord Shiva. So just to continue on in what happens in, then we sort of move on chapters 18 and 19. In chapter 18, we have a lot of chronology and descendants of Aditi, a lot of lineages, which are described. And then after that, the main part of the chapter is Diti's curse of Indra. Now, as you may remember, Diti and Aditi are sisters. And They're both married to Kashyapa, aren't they? Yeah, they're both married to Kashyapa Muni. And Diti was the mother of all the demons. Sometimes they're called the Daityas, which are the sons of Diti. And Aditi was the mother of many great demigods, including Indra, and great saints and sages, and many exalted personalities. So we had the demons and the devotees all being born from Diti and Aditi, who I believe are sisters, and both married to Kashyapa Muni. So it's kind of a interesting situation here. So what happens is being the mother of the Diti wasn't particularly demoniac herself, but being the mother of the demons, she was the mother of Hiranyakasipu and Hiranyaksha. And they were, of course, both killed by Lord Vishnu. And Lord Vishnu acts on behalf of the demigods, or at least in Diti's mind, it was actually to protect Indra and to save the demigods that Vishnu killed her two sons, Hiranyakasipu and Hiranyaksha. Therefore, she wanted to curse Indra and kill Indra. So she wanted to have a son who would be the cause of the death of Indra. So she appealed to her husband Kashyapa Muni in so many ways and asked if she could have a benediction. She was very sweet, very pleasing. Kashyapa Muni says, "Of course, anything you want, I'll give to you." He says, "Well, I want a son who will kill Indra." And he goes, "Oh no, what have I done?" You know. So in other words, he had to fulfill, he had promised her, and of course he's a man of great character, and he had to fulfill his promise, but the same way he didn't want to kill Indra, because he's generally favorable to the demigods, of course, and to the devotees. So he outlines a vrata, this punsavana vrata, that for 1 year, he gave her a child, she's pregnant, and for this year, they always call it a year for some reason, although it's probably not quite a year, at the time of her pregnancy, she had to perform this very severe punsavata vrata. And actually, chapter 19 is the full description of what you do in this punsavana vrata. So that's chapter. It goes back then in chapter 19, describes all the detail of a way that you can get all these benedictions and have a good son and all these things you want through this particular austerity. Not that we particularly recommend it. It's at a different time, a different age for particular, and actually for material purposes to some degree. But it also is all centered around the worship of Vishnu. So in other words, it looks as though it's a materialistic sacrifice, but it actually helps one to develop their devotional service and to serve, because it's all directed towards the service of Vishnu. At any rate, she couldn't make a mistake. This was the deal. You had to do it perfectly. You had to wash at a certain time. You couldn't eat this before that. You had to do all of these elaborate ceremonies. Make one mistake, and he said, if you make a mistake, it will not be a son who will kill Indra, but a son who will be a friend of Indra. So now Diti is Indra's aunt, and she was actually staying with him. He's sort of taking care of her at the same time she's plotting to kill him. But so Indra, being very intelligent and having a certain amount of mystic power, understands this. So he is serving her and bringing her, things for the sacrifice and everything, knowing the intent of it, and he's waiting for one slip. He's waiting for a mistake. Because he knows that if she makes a mistake, it won't come about. So finally, she makes a mistake. She's exhausted from the severe penance and austerity. She's supposed to wash her hands and everything before she takes rest. She forgot to do that. She was so tired, she just went and took rest. So Indra sees his chance. So somehow or another, by his powers, he enters into her womb to kill the unborn child. So with all his, he's got thunderbolt weapons and all kinds of good stuff, and he cuts the unborn child, the embryo, into 7 pieces. And then he cuts all of them again into another 7, so there's 49, and they all, but they're not dead. They're still, now they're 49 children, 49, what do we call it? Fetuses in the embryo, I guess. Anyway, there's 49 of them, and finally he's realizing that, this is something very unusual happening here, and they all appeal to him. They're called the Maruts. These are the 49 Maruts who are actually demigods. You know, they're great souls. And they say, we are your brother. Why are you trying to kill us? And anyway, he finally realizes that they are not his enemies. They really are his brothers and his friends. And so then they're born and they all become friends. And DT realizes that this was a great mistake trying to do this. And everything ends happily in this particular chapter. So that's basically brings us up to the end of the sixth canto. Anyway, it's a lot of interesting information. You probably want to go back and read through the verses more carefully. Okay, now we're up to 6:17:28. As I said, this is Lord Shiva speaking about the qualities of the devotees, specifically the quality in reference to King Chitraketu. Okay. So, responsibly. Narayana Parasarve.
Narayana Parasarve.
Nakutaschana bibhyati,
Svarga pavarga narakeshu,
Apituliarta darshanaha. There's a V on the end of narakesh because actually the two lines are actually one line. So in Sanskrit, a U before the vowel turns to a V, so it'd be narakesh vapi, but since we're breaking it up, I think we go back to the U. Is that your understanding? I think that's the best way to do it. Narayana parasarve,
nakatushchana bibhyati,
svarga pavarga narakeshu, apituliarta darshanaha,
Narayana Paraksarve,
Nakutaschana Bibhyati,
Svarga Pavarga Narakesu,
Apituliarta Darshanaha. Others? Narayana para.
Narayana para,
pure devotees who are interested only in the service of Narayan, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Sarve, all. Na, not. Katashchana,
anywhere.
Bibhyati,
are afraid.
Svarga, in the higher planetary systems. Apavarga, in liberation. Narakeshu, and in hell. Api,
even.
Tulya, equal. Arta,
value.
Darshana, who see. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Devotees solely engaged in the devotional service of the Supreme Personality of Godhead Narayan never fear any condition of life. For them, the heavenly planets, liberation, and the hellish planets are all the same. For such devotees are interested only in the service of the Lord. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. Parvati might naturally have inquired how devotees became so exalted. Therefore, this verse explains that they are Narayana Para, simply dependent on Narayan. They do not mind reverses in life, because in the service of Narayan, they have learned to tolerate whatever hardships there may be. They do not care whether they are in heaven or in hell. They simply engage in the service of the Lord. This is their excellence. Anya anukulyena krishnanu shilanam. They are liberally engaged in the service of the Lord, and therefore they are excellent. By using the word bricha brichanam, which you don't see in this verse because it was in the previous verse, and bricha brichanam is translated in the previous verse as servant of the servant. By using the word bricha brichanam, Lord Shiva pointed out that although Chitraketu provided one example of tolerance and excellence, all the devotees who have taken shelter of the Lord as eternal servants are glorious. They have no eagerness to be happy by being placed in the heavenly planets, becoming liberated, or becoming one with Brahman, the supreme effulgence. These benefits do not appeal to their mind. They are simply interested in giving direct service to the Lord. Om Jnana Timrandisha Gana Jana Salakaya Chakshun Mitamina Tasma Shigarve Namaha Vanchakalpa Trivishcha Krivasindavivicha Patitano Pavane Vyavaishvavin Mo Namaha. So, very important verse. This verse is explaining the position of pure devotional service. This is the actual position of a devotee. And as described here, the devotee is not concerned whether they are in Svarga, the upper planetary systems, or Narakeshu, the hellish planets, or whether they are Upavarga, or whether they are liberated, whether they become completely free from this material world in the liberated state of life. Why is that? Because, Prabhupada says here, because they are Narayana Para. They're simply dependent on Narayan. And of course, Narayan being the Supreme Personality of Godhead, for us, we might say that we are completely dependent upon Krishna. Same idea. Now, this is, of course, a very exalted state. This is a very elevated state of consciousness where one simply depends upon Krishna, simply depends upon the mercy of the Lord for everything. And therefore, because one is completely dependent upon and completely trusting in Krishna, then whatever material status of life one finds oneself in is really of very little concern. So this idea that the devotee is completely surrendered to Krishna, I've learned not to park in front of the trash can. You know, I did that last time. Excuse me. I park in front of someone else, though, you mean. Anyway, the devotee is completely surrendered to Krishna. In fact, this is one of the symptoms of surrender, is that idea that one is expecting the mercy of the Lord, expecting the protection of the Lord at all times. There's a nice verse I wanted to read. It's in the Chaitanya Charitamrita Majjha 22.100. It's actually from the Hari Bhakta Vilas. And it's about the six symptoms of surrender, or six divisions of surrender. It's quite nice. Anukulyasya sankalpa, pratikulyasya varjanam, rakshayashati vishvaso, goptrudevaranam tata, atma nikshepa karpanye sadvida sharanagati. The six divisions of surrender are the acceptance of those things favorable devotional service, rejection of unfavorable things, so that's the anukulyasya sankalpa, pratikulyasya varjanam, and then specifically, in reference to today's verse, the conviction that Krishna will give protection. This is one of the symptoms of surrender. Also, the acceptance of the Lord as one's guardian or master, full self-surrender and humility. So these are ways that we can understand that one has advanced in Krishna consciousness as in experiencing this process of full surrender or full trust in the Lord. It's really the idea that one, whatever one happens, one has this trust, or we often say faith, that this faith is very strong, that in any condition of life, they'll be taken care of by Krishna. And of course, we also have Krishna's assurance of this. The devotee's faith is strong because Krishna says, in 1866, Sarvadharmam Prachaja, Mamikam Sharanam Vraja. And then and he says, Ma Suchaha, do not fear. Very clearly, he says, do not fear. So, in that, just from the purport of in the Bhagavad Gita, Srila Prabhupada says, one should be confident that in all circumstances, Krishna will protect him from all difficulties. There is no need of thinking how one should keep the body and soul together. Krishna will see to that. One should always think himself helpless and should consider Krishna the only basis for his progress in life. As soon as one seriously engages in devotional service to the Lord in full Krishna consciousness, he at once becomes free from all contaminations of material nature. So in this way, because there is this full faith and Krishna has given his assurance to the devotee, then whatever situation one finds oneself in is really not so important. It's actually secondary to the devotee, because the devotee's concern is that he has service, that we have our ability to serve Krishna in all circumstance. And of course, this is a very elevated stage of the pure devotee, but yet one we should understand and we should be aspiring to and sort of working towards that. And as we go through the process of devotional service in our lifetime, we can sort of use that as a benchmark. Are we really making progress? How close am I coming to this standard of full surrender to Krishna? Because we find often that for many of us, our service is somewhat conditional. In other words, if conditions are right, if everything is favorable, if I'm being treated nicely, if I have everything I need, yeah, then I'll perform devotional service. Otherwise, I may not be so inclined. Now, unfortunately, of course, that's a material consciousness, because we're putting material conditions or material situations on that devotional service. Of course, in the conditioned state, that's natural. But it's something for us to clearly think about and to try to understand that, you know, is my service really one that I'm giving purely from my heart to Krishna, or is it only when things are favorable to me, only when I'm feeling good about what I'm doing, that I'm being praised for what I'm doing, I'm being recognized, or if I'm finding that it's comfortable for me? You know, that's not really the mood of the devotee. The mood of the devotee is what is favorable to Krishna, what is pleasing to Krishna, how can I please Krishna, and in that way I become pleased. It's not as though, like some people might think, well, that sounds like slavery or something, or that, you know, in other words, you're doing everything for somebody else, or they might think it looks codependent, or you have low self-esteem, or so many other things. These are all material conceptions of life. These are not understanding the spiritual dynamic and relationship between Krishna and the living entity, because that dynamic is one of love and service. So in the same way that the devotee is giving one's full love and service to Krishna, Krishna is reciprocating. And Krishna is saying, I will give you my full protection, do not fear. And Krishna's love for us is so much greater than we can even imagine, what to speak of reciprocate. It's not that the jiva is going to lose. It's not that we're going to suffer from the process of surrendering. Rather, we gain everything. Rather, we become fully happy in that process, because we're restored to our natural process, our natural position of devotional service, which will ultimately give us that happiness that we're looking for. So Krishna assures his protection, and the process of pure devotional service is being described here. A verse that Prabhupada quotes here is from the Bhaktivinoda Sindhu, Anukulyena Krishnanu Shilanam. This is, of course, from 1.1.11, Bhaktivinoda Sindhu, Nectar Devotion. And this is a very, very important verse. I'll just read the full verse here. And I looked in the database, and Prabhupada quotes this verse 492 times, but who's counting? Anyway, it's very important, and Srila Prabhupada, you know, refers to this verse many, many times in many, many purports. And the full verse is in Chaitanya Charitamrita as well. Anyabhilashita shunyam gyanakarmanyanarvita anukulyena krishnanushilanam bhaktirutama. And the translation in this is Bhanu Swami's translation. The highest bhakti is defined as continuous service or emotions directed towards Krishna, his expansions, forms, or others related to him, with a pleasing attitude toward Krishna. It should be devoid of desires other than the desire to please the Lord, and unobstructed by impersonal jnana, materialistic rituals of karma, or other unfavorable acts. So this is after the introductory verses in the Bhakti Saramita Sindhu. Rupa Goswami gives us, this is practically speaking, the first verse of instruction. And it's such an important verse. It's actually described as the Paribhasya Sutra of the Bhakti Saramita Sindhu. Now, a Paribhasya Sutra is a short verse. A sutra is like, you know, just like one, it's not a long verse, it's a very, very short phrase that gives the essence. And the Paribhasa Sutra gives the essence of the entire work. So, I may have talked about this before, I'm not sure. But in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Jiva Goswami talks about the Paribhasa Sutra, one line which is the summation of the Bhagavatam, and everything else is built around that. Anybody have a guess on what that one line is? Well, Jiva Goswami says it's Krishna's tu Bhagavan Swayam. In other words, that's the essence, that Krishna is the source of all incarnations. Krishna is the source of everything. Everything is coming from him. In other words, that verse, particularly, you know, because all the demigods are described and all the incarnations are described. And then it says, but of all of these incarnations, Krishna's tu Bhagavan Swayam. Krishna is the original Bhagavan, the origin of all. So in other words, that verse establishes the position of Krishna very clearly. So in other words, then the whole Bhagavatam is sort of an expansion of that concept of how Krishna is that supreme Bhagavan. So in the same way, this verse defines pure devotional service. And the rest of the Nectar Devotion is an expansion of an explanation of pure devotional service. So therefore, it's a very, very important verse. And so if we look at that verse a little more closely, you find that there's three primary characteristics of pure devotional service that are given. First, that Krishna is the sole object of devotion, that it rejects worship of demigods or worship of Brahman or worship even of Paramatma. In other words, it's, the verse that Prabhupada, the second line that Prabhupada quoted in the purport, Anuklinena Krishna Anushilanam. In other words, that it's directed specifically at Krishna. That's the nature of pure devotion. Secondly, that it must be favorable. This anukulyena means that it's favorable devotional service. And in the commentaries, they say, well, why do you have to say that? Of course, devotional, you know, they say, well, no, because one could be thinking of Krishna constantly, but it could be unfavorable. An example is given of Kamsa. All right, Kamsa thought about Krishna day and night. Every place he looked, but he thought of Krishna as the source of his death. It wasn't in a favorable, loving way. So it needs to be favorable. And Krishna Anushilanam means that one is fully engaged in devotional service. In other words, that it's as the Bhagavatam says, that it's a haituki yata priyata, unmotivated, uninterrupted. In other words, it's constant, uninterrupted devotional service. And this is the definition of uttama bhakti, which is first-class devotional service or the highest service. So we have this understanding. And then, kind of, also, and Prabhupada, the way he's used this verse in explaining today's verse, that's actually the second half of this verse. The way this verse is constructed is first it says what devotional service is not. Then it says what it is. So what we just described is what devotional service is. That it's constant, that it's favorable, that it's only directed towards Krishna, and then one is fully engaged. So then the secondary characteristics are given. So just like, actually this is it's interesting because my field was educational psychology, and one of the things that is often taught to teachers is ideas of what they call concept learning. And there's a lot of techniques and methods by which you teach, you know, children or anyone in school particular concepts. And one of the methods of concept learning is that you give examples and counterexamples. So just like if I'm teaching young children what a square is, I give them an example of a square. But then I also want to show them things that may seem similar but aren't a square, like what, a rectangle, or, you know, something else with four sides, or a, you know, but they're not equal, or a, what's it, trapezoid, or what's it called when it's like slanted, a rhombus? It's not
parallelogram.
Parallelogram. So in other words, you know, so that's not it either because the angles aren't all 90 degree. So in other words, the child might be confused if you say it's just a four-sided figure. You also have to show other examples of what it's not, and then the person tends to get it. So a lot of our verses and a lot of instruction in the Bhagavatam, you notice, is like that too. There's examples and counterexamples. So first we hear what pure devotional service is not, because this might look like devotion, but it isn't. So that's why we have the first part, Anyabhilashita Shunyam Jnana Karmanyanavrita. So in other words, it's not jnana, it's not the search for knowledge, it's not karma, It's not, you know, doing fruitive activities, pious activities for promotion to higher planets, and it's not anavritamis and others. And Prabhupada explained those others are things like mystic yoga and anything else. So karma, jnana, yoga, that probably pretty much covers it. You know, or so in other words, it has to be focused strictly on bhakti, on devotion. Otherwise, it's not devotional service. So devotional service means that we reject all of these other things, we reject other processes, and we focus on favorable service exclusively towards Krishna. And that's the basic definition of pure devotional service. Now, so that's what's being described here, is what is actually devotional service, and specifically pure devotional service. What does that look like? What are its symptoms? And Lord Shiva is showing how Chitraketu Maharaj embodies this perfection of a pure devotee, because he doesn't have any interest in whether he goes to higher planets or lower planets, no interest in karma. You know, he's certainly not interested. He already has all yogic powers and all knowledge. He's not interested in that. That's unimportant to him. He's only interested in bhakti, that one is enabled to serve Krishna in any circumstance of life, whether it be favorable or unfavorable. So this is very important. This is an important conception here. Question before we continue?
I read somewhere that one can perform pure devotional service only in a liberated stage. So is that right?
Yes and no. In one sense, Prabhupada explained that by becoming a devotee, one is liberated. So yes, one can only perform devotional service in a liberated state, but as soon as one performs devotional service, he's liberated. So it's kind of a, you know, one of those kind of situations. Are we performing pure devotional service? Myself, no. Some of you may be, but many of us probably are not yet at the stage of pure devotional service. But in the sense, we are liberated because if we are following the instructions of the spiritual master, engaged in bhakti, you know, we are no longer performing ordinary karmic activity. And therefore, it's just simply a matter of time separating us from that stage of pure devotion. Okay? One thing that sometimes we might think about is this realistic? Because, you know, sometimes we can think, wow, I mean, this is all wonderful. I mean, I can appreciate the great devotees that are in the Bhagavatam, but does this apply to me? You know, I have so far to go, I can't even imagine that. You know, my service might be conditional on whether the prasadam is good, what to speak of in heaven or hell, you know. Like, eh, prasadam's not good, I'm out of here, you know, or whatever it might be, you know. That, you know, so... can one completely be in the stage of Mahasu Jahad, do not fear, that one has no concern for the body? One thing it's important to understand that, you know, to have some concern for the body is not unusual. It's a natural state, and in fact, it's you know, because the soul is within the body. And we've been in these bodies for so many lifetimes, it's natural that identification is very, very difficult to break. And I thought that it's interesting because, by the way, there's in the Bhagavad Sarvami Descendo, this is a really nice edition, Bhano Swami Maharaj is translated. There's about 12 pages of purports to this verse that we read in the commentaries by Jiva Goswami and Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. And it's interesting that on this point, I wanted to just read this one thing that Vishwanath says about this idea of, can we be completely free from this, you know, ever, like, you know, caring for the body? Do we just have no concern whatsoever? I mean, not that we just walk in front of a car, who cares, you know? No, of course not. I mean, it's Krishna's body. It's you know, for our service. We need to be intelligent and reasonable. But even if we sometimes have that immediate fear, Vishwanath is saying, don't be too concerned about it. He actually describes in his commentary, he says, the phrase anyabhilashita shunyam has been chosen. Anyabhilashita, this ita on the end, for some reason has an important Sanskrit grammatical meaning, which I don't understand at all, but accepting the words of our acharyas. He says, this means devoid of other desires which are as deep-rooted as one's nature. In death-threatening situations, a devotee may say, "Oh Lord, please save me, your devotee, now from this danger." So we might think in contrast, example, Prahlad Maharaj, when he was in a death-threatening situation, did he say, "Oh Lord, please save me"? Not really, did he? He just chanted the holy name. He just depended on Krishna. He didn't even ask Krishna to save him at that time. But that's one of the reasons why we have about, an entire canto devoted to Prahlad Maharaj practically, because he's such an exalted devotee on this exemplary level. But for most of us, we're not on that level. So Vishwanath says, the devotee may say, "Oh Lord, please save me, your devotee, now from this danger. Because it is a sudden, temporary desire, it is not harmful to bhakti. That is because this desire arises beyond his control, opposite of his devotional nature. That desire is not his nature." In other words, our true nature is just for pure devotional service and not identifying with the body. But he said because it's so deep-rooted, it's natural that we would naturally want to, be protected in a moment of danger. He said, so, don't worry about it too much. That's a natural reaction. And at least one is asking Krishna to save them. Right, so that's very favorable. If I said, "Oh, please, somebody else save me," or just, in other words, if one is wanting to turn to Krishna for protection, that's all right. There's nothing wrong with that. Particularly as in our stage. Yeah, you had a question?
Yes, my name's Clayton. I am visiting here for class from Santa Fe, and I noticed you said about a difference between a karma experience and a everyday karma experience, or there's a difference between what? I didn't get that. The difference between that.
Okay, you're saying the difference between a devotee experiencing normal karmic?
Normal karmic.
Yeah. Okay, let me try to explain.
I don't want to waste your time.
No. That's a very good question, actually, and I probably am going through a lot of things quite quickly here. In other words, all of us experience karma actions and reactions from our past. In other words, whatever behavior we do, there'll be a certain reaction for it. It's described that for a devotee that one becomes free from that cycle of karma. In other words, once one becomes a devotee and surrenders to Krishna, then rather than karmic reactions happening as they do somewhat mechanically. In other words, it's very much guided by very strict rules of nature. It's almost like a physical reaction, like I throw a ball against the wall and it bounces back. That's just an automatic sort of reaction. Well, karma is a little bit like that, although it's more personally handled. But for a devotee, the example is given that even though we may suffer some reaction, rather than throwing the ball against the wall and having it bounce back, it's like Krishna catches it and tosses it back to us. So in other words, it's not ordinary karma. It's Krishna is dealing directly with his devotee, and he deals in such a way for our benefit, for our advancement. So sometimes we need to learn certain lessons, so we may have to suffer certain reactions. Actually, I'm going to get to that in a minute, about how the devotee understands those reactions that they might be experiencing. But that's the idea, that it's handled, that everything that happens to a devotee is his part of his personal relationship with God.
But is there not a difference? There's not all karma, not all bad, or all...
No, karma can be positive or negative, depending upon... obviously, if one does pious activities or good activities, then one gets a good result, and of course, bad activities will get a more negative result. But see, the devotee wants to get out of the karmic cycle altogether. We don't want to get we certainly don't want bad results, but we also aren't so concerned with just getting good karma or getting elevated. We want to get, free from the whole cycle of birth and death. The idea is to get out of this material world, to get out of the karmic cycle, and go back to Krishna, back to Godhead. So that's why we're saying that even though karma may be good or bad, favorable or unfavorable, the platform of devotional service says we're not really so concerned with karma. Okay? Yeah. Maybe some of the devotees can, talk a little more with you afterwards. I think these are really important points, and it's a great question. Thank you. Appreciate it. Okay. So... and that kind of brings us, that was a very good point he brought up, because it kind of brings us to just, I guess, the last thing I wanted to mention here, is that what should be our mood? our mood is, we can say, yes, heaven or hell, I don't care, you know, whatever happens. But sometimes that's rather difficult for us. I may not be quite at an elevated stage. And I may be experiencing some of these reactions, as we were describing. And even though that they may be Krishna directly handling them, or that they may be just the winding down of my karma from the past, and I know that this will come to an end, and eventually I will become purified, it might be difficult while we're experiencing those things. And so what should the mood of the devotee be, trying to surrender to Krishna, but still experiencing some of these reactions and experiencing difficulties or anxieties or tribulations within this material world? I think it's an important thing, because devotees are confronted with these things, and we need to think about and understand these things. Fortunately, Lord Brahma had the same issue, and he described the situation fairly nicely for us in the 10th canto, 14th chapter, in Brahma's prayers to Lord Krishna after he steals the cows and the cowherd boys. And, of course, he's bewildered. It's the Brahma Mohana, you know, Leela. He becomes bewildered by Krishna. He comes, he finally understands, he surrenders to Krishna, and he's in a very repentant mood, because he had tried to kind of show up Krishna, then he realized, this is ridiculous, who am I? Krishna is so much more powerful, and he really didn't quite understand that this little boy playing with the cows really was the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Now, of course, all his illusion has been removed, and he's offering nice prayers to Krishna. And, of course, verse 8 is very, very well-known, Tate Nakampam Nusamikshamanam. A very nice verse where Lord Brahma says, "My dear Lord, any person who is constantly awaiting your causeless mercy to be bestowed upon him and goes on suffering the resultant action of his past misdeeds, offering you respectful obeisances from the core of his heart, is surely eligible to become liberated, for it has become his rightful claim." So this is the mood that Lord Brahma, who is, of course, the first in our disciplic line, having heard the core verses of the Srimad Bhagavatam directly spoken to him within the heart, being the founder of our Brahma Gaudiya Sampradaya. He is giving such a wonderful example for us of the mood of a devotee. So he's saying, even if we do need to suffer some resultant actions of our past misdeeds, you know, we're willing to do that, but we continue devotional service, continuing offering obeisances from within the core of my heart, he's saying. So in other words, this mood is always there, and just like Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu also described, you know, that you may kick me, you may handle me roughly by your embrace, it doesn't matter. I am your servant life after life, birth after birth. However you may handle me, it's all right. You know, I accept my relationship to you in pure loving service. So, Srila Prabhupada wrote a nice purport. Of course, this is chapter 14. Prabhupada wasn't able to directly comment. You know, he wasn't able to complete this portion of the Bhagavatam. But in the Nectar Devotion, there's a chapter called Expecting the Lord's Mercy. Very appropriate. And Prabhupada writes about this verse. And it's a very nice purport. Prabhupada says, "The statement of Srimad Bhagavatam should be a guide for all devotees. A devotee should not expect immediate relief from the reactions of past misdeeds. No conditioned soul is free from such reactionary experiences, because material existence means continuing suffering or enjoying a past activity. If one has finished his material activities, then there is no more birth. This is possible only when one begins Krishna conscious activities, because such activities do not produce reaction. Therefore, as soon as one becomes perfect in Krishna conscious activities, he is not going to take birth again in this material world. A devotee who is not perfectly freed from the resultant actions, that's me, should therefore continue to act in Krishna consciousness seriously, even though there may be so many impediments. When such impediments arise, he should simply think of Krishna and expect his mercy. That is the only solace. If the devotee passes his days in that spirit, it is certain that he is going to be promoted to the abode of the Lord. By such activities, he earns his claim to enter into the kingdom of God." Okay. So I'll stop on that note. Some questions, comments? Balaganta Prabhu?
On that verse, Srila Prabhupada explains in other places that the if a person has an inheritance, the end of the verse is Mukti Pade Sadayabak, right? You get your freedom, your liberation, by continuously remembering Krishna in that way. So Prabhupada said that it's like somebody has an inheritance. Any heirs in the room? So if somebody has left you something in their will, you just have to do one thing to get it. What is that? Yeah, you just have to stay alive. So Krishna consciousness is like that. Basically, if you just keep hanging in there, then you go back to Godhead. If you stay alive in Krishna consciousness, you get your inheritance.
It's actually, I find this verse is a very reassuring verse. It's a very, I mean, even though he's talking about suffering, it's actually a very hopeful verse, right? Because we're already suffering. So this is saying, if we just continue in this mood of devotion, as you said, it'll be our inheritance, you know. Yeah. And of course, liberation in this sense means devotional service. Liberation in the sense of being back with Krishna. Yes, Prabhu?
I was wondering about the sense of Vrindavan, about the residents of Vrindavan, how they would call out to Krishna in every situation, like when they have some demon comes, like they're like, oh, Krishna, Krishna, save us.
Right.
So I was wondering when you said, like, you mentioned Prahlad Maharaj's example, but at the same time, there is this example, so I'm kind of confused.